This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show veteran skydiver and stunt woman, Katie Hansen. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from her journey into the world of skydiving and wingsuits, the importance of fitness, diligence in training, her near-fatal skydiving near-miss, the psychological journey refinding her confidence in the sky, working on Thunderbolts, the Jimmy Chin project in the Sphere in Vegas, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Katie Hansen. Enjoy. Well, Katie, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Eric Salas, for making this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I am in Leadville, Colorado. And I arrived here about an hour ago.
And what's taken you there?
I live in Moab, Utah, and it's super hot during the summer. And so my husband, Matt, and I have been staying away this summer, and we spent a month in Washington State. And now for August, we're going to be kind of home based out of here and then head back in September when it's a little bit nicer there.
Yeah. If you're escaping the heat, I'm glad you didn't come to Florida. It's been brutal here, like in 106, 108 with the humidity. So
yeah, no, rough. No, thank you.
All right. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Sure. So I was born in Portland, Oregon, but moved to Washington State when I was maybe 3 or 4 years old and consider Washington State home. So I grew up in a few different places there, but you know, my high school years and things like that, I lived in Gig Harbor, Washington, and my family still has roots out there today. We've got a beach house we spend time at every summer on the Puget Sound, and the Pacific Northwest definitely feels like home to me. even though I moved away in 2006 to California and, you know, started a whole other journey then. But I am extremely fortunate with my family. I grew up thinking it was normal and realize now it's probably more of an exception that I'm really close with my whole family. My parents are celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary this year and are great examples of a loving relationship, good communication, and caring about their kids. And that doesn't mean that we haven't all had our rifts or made mistakes, but I know that they'll always be there for me. And they, throughout my life, have been people that I could rely on and turn to when I needed advice or when I was screwing up, that they would get me back in line. I have a brother and a sister. Both are amazing people. I'm the youngest and grew up being tortured by them, of course. And, you know, we became, I would say, good friends as we became older. And that's more or less, you know, my family dynamics in a nutshell. I guess I can add, my dad was an actuary growing up, like a branch of mathematician, basically, super smart. My mom has a degree in microbiology, but her job growing up was to take care of us. And I think it's a blessing when a parent can stay home and raise their kids themselves. And we were fortunate enough to have that be our circumstance. And, you know, they were really involved with sports and, you know, timing at track meets and driving me to soccer practice and all that kind of stuff. So very lucky with my family.
It's so good to hear, because you're right, especially in a lot of professions in uniform, you know, there is actually a lot of struggles in our early life, which I think partly sends us to this. But even, you know, your sport, there's a lot of people that I feel, you know, there were some voids early on, and some of the skydivers, for example, that come on the show that were filled by that adrenaline, that excitement. Mm-hmm. When you look back now, what were the elements of your parents' upbringing that you think forged this loving relationship when they met each other?
My parents both are, they're incredible people. They love, they have it together. You know, they met in college and they, as far as I know, basically fell in love on a ski trip and enjoying the outdoors and pursuing life, you know, and they, I think, walk a pretty nice balance between real jobs and having it together and providing and, you know, being responsible with a love for fun in the outdoors and, you know, being adventurous people.
So what about sports? Obviously, we're going to get to the extreme sports you do now. What were you playing and doing when you were in the school ages?
I started doing club track when I was 9 and did that through high school. And soccer was always a huge, you know, I played really competitive soccer from probably kindergarten up through high school.
I always ask people this, that when they've done individual sports and they've done team sports, mm-hmm. what did you glean from each of those that then served you later in life?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I love both team sports and individual sports. I think individual sports, there's like, it's very good for your confidence to know that you're the one who performs, you know, like if you did well, it was all on you. And I think especially growing up, self-confidence was kind of a central theme for me looking back. You know, it's been kind of an important thing, and I don't know if, not really sure why, but that was one of the things that boosted my self-confidence. Like when you place in state or you excel or you win a meet, that was you, you know, when it came down to it in the moment. And with team sports, there's so many good lessons that come from team sports. From leadership, you know, when there's been teams where I've fallen into a captain role, and it really is about the team, not yourself, you know, or setting up someone else to succeed because that makes the team succeed, or really having each other's backs through the difficult times and celebrating together. It just like it bonds you and you feel what it's like to be part of a community. And I think that's a really special thing as well.
Speaking of women's soccer, the British Lions, or the Is it England Lions or British Lions? I forget now. But our female football team, I think it was England Lions. They just won again. They've won, I think, several times now. But around this time with, you know, obviously my social media was looking at women's football, soccer. There came up a story as well where I think it was Spain. They had used this video as a promo for women's soccer. And it was the highlight of all these great goals and tackles and headers and all the things. And then as the commercial goes on, they show how they did it. And what they actually did was used AI to replace the women's faces with men's faces. So actually what you were seeing the whole time was women's soccer. And so using today's technology, it was kind of, debunking the myth that, you know, female sports weren't as good to watch, for example, because you were all in when you thought it was men, but it was the whole time it was women that you're watching. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. Really. What a cool little social experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what about career aspirations? Again, as you're progressing through the school age, what were you dreaming of becoming back then?
Oh, man. I had to kind of come to terms with, it was interesting because I grew up in a family where, you know, the expectation, not because it was pushed on you, but that's just the example set before you, was going to college, you know, getting a degree and getting a job and playing on the weekends and setting yourself up for retirement later in life and having a family. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with any of those things at all. But I found that they weren't necessarily a good fit for me, and having to kind of come to terms with that and realizing that there's more than one correct path to take through life. And even though what I thought was going to be, you know, my future as I grew up turned out to not be what I wanted, and having to realize that that didn't mean that I was failing. It was me just kind of growing as a person and discovering who I was. And I started skydiving when I was 18, the day before I walked for high school graduation. Fell in love with it, and we can get into that, you know, later. But I knew that I did want a fallback career no matter what. I wanted to be responsible, and I found that kind of a balance between something that, you know, I'm a very nurturing person, despite some of my rough exterior sometimes. I deeply care about people, and nursing was a career that needed people, and also had a very flexible work schedule, and there was always going to be a need. It was a growing field, you know, and I didn't want to be so naive that I just, you know, got a degree in something that wasn't going to set me up for a job later. If I was going to go to school, I wanted it to be something that actually I could use the degree for. So I decided to go to nursing school, and did. I went to nursing school and graduated as an RN in at the very end of 2009. So I've been a nurse since 2010, and have spent, you know, basically since then kind of flip-flopping or meshing between full-time skydiving and working as a nurse, you know, and eventually got into travel nursing, but kind of found a balance between the two ish. I feel like I'm a pendulum, and I go from like working too hard nursing and feeling like I need to be responsible and then being miserable and then quitting that job, or, you know, that contract would end and then I would just like pendulum the other way into, you know, eat, sleep, breathing, skydiving, working on the drop zone. And, you know, I've kind of done a lot of different jobs within skydiving in terms of, you know, I was a packer for a season and packed other people's parachutes, and quickly realized I wanted to be in the air all the time and started, you know, shooting video for tandems, and didn't get my tandem rating until I think I had 7,500 skydives, because I didn't want to have to do tandems, because I didn't want my own personal progression to suffer. And once people get a tandem rating and start doing tandems, they have a tendency not to work on their own personal flying. But my solution to that was, you can't make me do tandems if I don't have a rating. So I just didn't get one until I felt like I had kind of safely avoided that trap. And then, so anyway, kind of to answer, I kind of flip-flop between nursing and nursing and skydiving.
I want to take a dive into the nursing, but just before we do, you'd be an interesting person to get a perspective on this. When I came over to the States from the UK, one of the big kind of realizations was I kept meeting, you know, what I would determine as Uncle Ricos. So all these guys that were kind of late 20s, early 30s, deconditioned by this point, and they would always have I woulda, coulda, shoulda been story, you know, with the football, with baseball, whatever it was. And as time went on, especially now with the podcast, I start speaking to high level athletes and coaches and, you know, people from you know, different walks of life, I realized that there is a danger of, you know, when you forge performance with a child, with a youth athlete, a high school, a college, that it can be done at the detriment of wellness, of longevity. And you do, you know, see a lot of broken athletes when they're literally 18, 19, 20 years old. And I think that then is a huge dissuader for continuing to just simply enjoy sports, to simply move, to simply play. What was your experience as you walked through when you were playing football at a high level?
That's a good question. And do you mean like the physical ramifications of it because you're injuring your joints, or do you mean like the emotional part where they're so burnt out, they hate the sport and don't want to do it anymore?
Yes and yes.
I loved sports, and I still do. And I think that for me personally, it was so beneficial. I still think of, and it's funny how some of the drills that I've spent so long doing in track, like warm up drills and stuff, I find have helped my flying, my free flying, which is so funny. One of the most influential people I think in my childhood was one of my track and cross country coaches in high school. And her name was Patty Lay. And she was like an Olympic caliber distance runner. And she instilled into us so much passion. And the thing that I think was so important and influential was about mindset and how your mindset can change your physical performance. And, you know, there's been a few key points in my life where I've really gone back and tried to analyze why they were key points. And I think that all of them kind of come down to a mindset shift. And there was one particular, it was just a practice that is like a core memory that stuck with me, was my track team was really good. My cross country team was really good and our workouts were hard. And I was on the varsity team and we were doing a really challenging workout that, I mean, you just want to die. You felt like you're going to puke if you hadn't already. You know, it's mentally exhausting. It's, you know, sprints that are, you know, distance length that you feel like you're sprinting with not enough rest and just you're worn out. And there was one left and everyone was just like, couldn't wait for it to be over. And she said to us, you don't just survive this one, which is what all of us were telling ourselves. She's like, you don't survive this one. You grab it by the throat and you murder this one. And it was, she meant it like with such force, and it was, got us so fired up. It's like, I don't think I've ever run so hard when I was already so tired, and went just that mindset shift. I'm like, oh, I got to get through this, just survival mode, to taking the opportunity to forge the most strengthened mindset so that when you come up running against other people, you break them and you watch their mind. You watch them think, oh, I'm not going to get left behind. You watch them realize that you're not going to give up and you're going to punish them, and you watch them quit and fall behind. And I think that those lessons that I learned in sports from her, it's not to say I wouldn't have learned them somewhere else, but sports is where I learned them, and I'm endlessly grateful for it. And I feel like my life is better off for having her be my coach and for doing sports when I was young.
So when you reflect back, what was it about the coaching and the environment that you were, you know, wrapped in that prevented the mental burnout, the physical injuries that we see with a lot of other people?
I did have some physical issues, and I think that honestly it came from, I don't really know what they were. Even I think back in like pushing myself so hard mentally that my body really did collapse. Like like passing out while you're running, basically. I don't know if it was like glycogen stores running dry, like your body physically, like generally when we're mentally fatigued, our body has so much more to give. And I feel like if you push past that point where your body actually gives out, that can cause psychological damage too. And there was definitely a period where my competitive drive was definitely reeled back. I felt like I had been damaged from it. And somewhere along the line got better and found my competitive drive again and pushed through it. So it's not to say there weren't setbacks, but I think in the grander scheme of things, it was important for me to have those lessons. And yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know what they did to necessarily prevent that from happening, because it kind of did happen. But yeah, just set good examples of caring and working hard, and that when you were struggling, you could come to them with anything, whether it was in your personal life or your schoolwork or your running, and knowing that they cared about me as a person and would be there for me to help me through, you know, those difficult times too, and didn't discard you because you were having issues or got replaced in your performance by someone that was behind you. You know, they cared and wanted to bring you back up.
Yeah, that's probably a big part of it too, then, because I know, you know, that mm-hmm. that loss of identity, that perceived failure, you know, we're talking about children, you know, so it's going to be crushing.
Yeah.
Walk to me through the nursing side then. So you go through the educational element, you enter the American medical system. You know, what were some of the aha moments for you? You know, the highs and the lows.
Oh, man. So when I started nursing school, I had already started skydiving. I started skydiving in 2003, moved to California in 2006, got into a really competitive nursing program. I basically scored in the top 1% on the entrance exam and got accepted to CSU Sacramento, to Sac State. And somewhere between when I applied for nursing school and got in and when I got out, things went from multiple job opportunities and signing bonuses to there not being any jobs for new grads. And that is demoralizing. And school was hard. And I was loving skydiving. By then I was working on the drop zone on the weekends, you know, doing schoolwork in between loads, studying in between jumps. And it was really hard. By the time I graduated, I crawled across the finish line. I did not want to be nursing. All I wanted to do was skydive. And so basically my you know, my choices when I graduated were, as a new grad, move away to somewhere else besides Northern California and get a job in a hospital, or take a terrible job at like a skilled nursing facility. And I was killing it in my skydiving career. I was up and coming. I was, you know, jumping all the time, and I didn't want to leave NorCal. I was thriving there. And so I opted to pursue skydiving and put that first, and had like a part-time job in a skilled nursing facility, which, man, I appreciate the hard workers there so much. It's a sad place to see what, you know, the laws, instead of protecting, you know, the nursing ratios and stuff, those nurses are overworked and the patients are under care for, not for a lack of compassion by the staff there, but by the people who run them and, you know, the tools they're given to work with is so sad. And so the job sucked. I hated it. It was hard. And you leave every day feeling like you should have done a better job because you're not given the tools you need to take care of the people the way you want to take care of them. And so when it was between that and full-time skydiving, it was a pretty easy choice for me. And all I did was make my resume for nursing worse and worse in a really competitive field to get jobs in hospitals, because, you know, there's hundreds of applicants for positions. So I spent the first 6 years of my nursing career skydiving and nursing very little. And it was through the skydiving network that someone was like, oh yeah, you want a job as a nurse? We're always hiring. On my unit, got an interview, got a job, which was intimidating after being out of the hospital and out of nursing school for 6 years before I got my first hospital job. And when I had that job for 1 year and 3 months, and I know that because it's the longest I've ever had a real job where you have to ask for time off. And I've only done it twice in my whole life. I don't do very well with being told I can't go play for extended periods of time. But, you know, it was California too. And I love California, but there's some quirky things about Californians and the way things run there. And I remember just getting pulled into the office. By that time, it was like every other day. I was always in trouble, and it was for stuff that was so dumb. And basically, you know, not to get into like the drama of working in the hospital, it was totally unwarranted. And the boss, she was the manager, because I think she couldn't cut it working on the floor. She'd only been a nurse for like 6 months, succumbed to the pressure of, you know, other people and whatever. For some reason, she kind of had it out for me. And I was in trouble once again for something like so dumb that was just pulling me off the floor, using our resource nurse to cover my patients instead of helping people that needed it. And I was miserable, you know, was just losing my hair from stress from going to this job that I was just miserable in. And I just said, thank you for the opportunity, for having worked here. This is my 2 weeks notice. I'm fucking out of here. And I quit and became a travel nurse, which was a much better fit because I could skydive full time for 6 months or 5 months at a time and then take a nursing contract for 3 months. You're not involved in any of the politics because you're only there for 3 months and you know, just pick the one thing, like, all right, what's your unit care about? This one thing, I'll do a great job doing that one thing. And then you're out of there after 3 months. And it was a better fit for me. And everyone says like, oh, nurses, travel nurses make better money. And for me, all that meant was, cool, I only have to work half as much. I can go skydive the other half. So I probably didn't do the best job in terms of getting ahead financially, but in terms of life experience and, you know, pursuing my passion, which has been skydiving since the first time I did it. It was a great opportunity for me.
Why was it so competitive? Was that post the 08 crash?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I left Anaheim, California right before that. And I suddenly, you know, went through a divorce, was thinking about going back to California, and they were like, nope, there's no jobs here anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting though, because if you know, in my profession and your profession, if you look back then how competitive it was, and now you look at today, you know, fire departments are offering signing bonuses. That's never, ever happened in the history of the fire service. And the same with nursing. And it's a reflection of not taking care of your people. That's really what it is. So 100%. There's so much. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many lessons that need to be learned. And I think, you know, in my profession, there's this kind of beginning of a revolution where they're realizing we can't work our people into the ground. They're literally dying. So we have to change something. So the work week is starting to change here in Florida, and it's going to go across the country. There's no question. But, you know, nursing needs the same thing. I mean, I hear it all the time, the danger of the ratios. And, you know, not only is it incredibly unfair to the nurses and behind everything from burnout to alcoholism to all the other things, but you know, the fact that patients are dying, patients are given the wrong doses, patients aren't given enough doses because you've got a nurse trying to run around that's also, you know, chronically overworked, sleep deprived, and just can't even think straight.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Couldn't agree more. It's we're expendable. They run you into the ground until you burn out and quit, and then they replace you. And, you know, it's just sad to see them spend that budget on new hires instead of paying their staff, you know, what they're worth. And the more frustrating thing too is, you know, they're looking at numbers on paper and their quarterlies, and what you can't put a monetary value on is like the culture of the unit. And especially now, you know, they put so much emphasis on patient satisfaction scores, and it's like, dude, yeah, it's frustrating to even talk about. It's like, just take care of your staff, you know, and everyone feels it. And yeah, it's such a valuable job, you know, and it could be such a great career, but it's just ruined by the people that are in charge of the hospitals.
Did you watch the show The Pit?
I loved it.
it was amazing.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's obviously it's a TV, so it's not perfect, but I thought it did a pretty good job of what it feels like to work in the ER. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we are getting the perspective of the medics in that show that walk through, we offload the patient, yeah. You know, we might hang out for a bit, find out why they're dying and then leave. But, yeah. You know, in COVID, you know, people were like, oh, there's patients in the hallway. The reporters was like, there's always fucking patients in the hallway. Have you not been paying attention the rest of the time? Like, and it's the same with exactly. And so then, you know, when you look at the patient satisfaction scores, you know, his character, the lead, is like, well, of course they're not satisfied. They're waiting 8 fucking hours for a bed. So how the hell are you supposed to get good, you know, scores when you're again understaffed and overworked? It's impossible.
Totally. Yeah. No, I loved that show. And other than I thought it was funny that the doctors did so much of the work that really the nurses do. But other than that,
yeah,
it was pretty accurate.
It was great. All right. Well, then let's kind of roll the clock back for a second to 18 years old. What was it that made you even want to try skydiving in the first place?
That's a good question. I get asked that a lot, and I'm not really sure what it was that sparked it. But I think I was about 14 years old, and I thought skydiving was so cool. And I think the big draw was I thought it was how cool, how much trust in themselves skydivers had. And I was like, that's insane. They can literally jump out of a plane and know with 100% certainty that they're going to do what they need to do under the pressure of being in free fall and deploy their parachute and land safely. And I thought that was so cool. And I knew that my dad had wanted to do a skydive when he was in college and never did it. And so we made a deal that we would go for, my dad and I just talked about this. I thought it was for my birthday. He said it was for graduation, but my birthday's in January. So in Washington State, that's pretty cold. But when I turned 18, I was like, all right, Dad, you remember our deal from a few years ago? And he was like, oh man, no, I didn't, but okay, let's do it. And we jumped the day before I walked for high school graduation. And I don't even think I had jumped yet. And I was like, oh yeah, this is for me. Like, I immediately felt like there wasn't anything wrong with me and I didn't need to keep trying to fit in anywhere. I was like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. I just found my people. Like, I'm good. And loved it from before I even made my first jump.
I've done two skydives in my life, one in New Zealand and then one. Did you ever jump with Sean Chuma?
Yeah. What's funny is Sean Chu was a good friend of mine and he's one of my husband's best friends. And I know I've been base jumping with him, but I actually don't think I've ever been skydiving with him. But we've flown wingsuits together in Europe and done jumps off the bridge at the Perrine. And yeah, Sean's wonderful. And I actually listened to his podcast he did with you.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. But did you jump with him? Did you skydive with him?
No, my second skydive was when we did 7X. So we went around the world with the Navy SEALs and all the guys. So I've done one in New Zealand, which was absolutely stunning, and then one over the pyramids from a Russian helicopter. So for a guy that's done two jumps, you know, I'm so spoiled. But the reason I say that is the first one, full transparency, I was shitting myself, metaphorically and literally, like in the McDonald's bathroom right before. But when I landed, I was like, this was amazing. Now, I never, you know, was in an environment to pursue it. You know, I was traveling around the world at the time, so I didn't find myself near a skydiving school. But I have to say, I went from sheer terror before to, again, landing going, I want to be an instructor. Mm-hmm. You know, full transparency, did not take those steps. But I see, you know, the absolute thrill from that. And then the second time was really interesting because I think post-fire service, the adrenal fatigue, I was doing almost like an experimentation. I'm like, well, this is from a helicopter this time. This is just a sheer drop. No, you know, no forward motion from an airplane and nothing. Had a blast, but didn't feel any adrenaline whatsoever. So I'm like, okay, I think I am a little broken from the fire service. But anyway, point being, I can resonate with that first time. That being said, though, you know, you found your people. How did that develop into such a love of skydiving that you ended up making it an entire profession?
I think it just developed organically. You know, it just, why do we love the things that we love? The people had a lot to do with it. The personal challenge, for sure. Like, it is terrifying when you first start. And I think that it's really gratifying to do things that are terrifying because it shows you the strength of overcoming those things. And, you know, after enough jumps go by, it's not terrifying anymore. And you realize, because you're given these tasks to do on each jump, and those are challenging. And then you get better at them and you complete those and start being given more challenging tasks. And it's like, it's not just the skydiving and the, you know, the adrenaline or anything like that. I love the people. I thought it was fun and I thought it was challenging, and it feels good to pursue challenge. And skydiving is really cool in the way that you don't have to be good at it for it to be fun. It's like a great example of enjoying the progression. The entire progression is really fun. And there's never going to be a moment, I think, where I feel like, all right, I'm good. You know, like, I'm on top. I don't have anything else to learn. So it's just continuously stimulating, whether that's, okay, now I'm good at doing this discipline. I want to go work on my wingsuiting, or I want to work on high performance canopy piloting. There's always more avenues and more challenges. And it is super fun. Like, it is really gratifying. You just dangle one thing in front of me. You're like, oh my God, that was the best thing ever. I can't wait to do more of that. And there's just like a never ending supply of that feeling.
So how did you transition into the wingsuit and base side? And then again, how many jumps did you have regularly before you made that transition?
I would like to preface this with, things were a little bit different back then. I definitely, there was no, like, nowadays there's like first flight courses. Like, you want to learn how to fly a wingsuit, you get 200 skydives. You sign up for a first flight course and you go with an instructor and they teach you. And none of that existed. And I think I had somewhere around 85 skydives when I put my first wingsuit on. And I was like an 18-year-old girl, and some dude gave me a wingsuit. And the wingsuits were really small back then, but still, I had probably had no business flying it. And then I don't think I flew it again for, I don't know, a year or two, basically till I moved to California. So maybe a year or two later. And I just walked into the drop zone with complete confidence. Nobody knew who I was. No one knew that I had no idea how to fly it. And I just showed up and manifested for a load and taught myself how to fly. And, that's definitely, you know, there's more efficient ways to learn how to be good at something. And it's definitely not the route I would recommend. But that is what I did. And that's my story. And then for, and actually, I guess an interesting part of that too, I should back it up. I went to Baffin Island, which is in the Canadian Arctic, for my first expedition in 2007. And I went back in 2008. And at that point, I had more base jumps than skydives. And I was so inspired by the people wingsuit base jumping up there that I decided I need to get back into skydiving and I'm going to learn how to fly a wingsuit. And it was that motivation that drove me to go back to the drop zone and put on a wingsuit and really like commit to learning how to fly and fly well. And I think I have my years messed up here. That was 2008 that I was driven to go back to the drop zone and get good at flying, because I went back in 2010 for my third expedition up there and did my first wingsuit base jump after I had been training for 2 years really hard and put in a lot of work. So yeah, that's what sparked me learning how to fly wingsuits and kind of just going and doing it. And then I decided I needed to get good at flying my body in general and like learn the more fundamental skills. So I didn't necessarily do anything in the order that made sense in general. and took off my wingsuit and really learned how to fly my body well without it, which in the long run made me a much more proficient wingsuit pilot also, because you can basically think of a wingsuit as like an amplifier, where if you're good at flying your body, because it gives you more surface area. So if you're doing things well, you have more power. And if you're not doing things well, it amplifies that also. So
the mistakes.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the path that I took through learning how to fly wingsuits. And in terms of how I learned how to base jump, this is another story of don't do things like I did them, but things were a little bit different back then. And I had 46 skydives when I started base jumping, which is not enough. And I was 18 and had gotten an academic scholarship to go to Montana State University. And by the time when I signed up to go there, I was so excited. And by the time it was time to go, I was so sad. I didn't want to go to Montana. I had started skydiving in that interim. Just wanted to be in Washington with my friends, and had met somebody there who was a base jumper who I ultimately ended up dating for like 5.5 years. And he was going to go base jumping in Twin Falls, Idaho. And I had convinced somebody, because I didn't have a car, that it would be fun to take a road trip to Twin Falls, Idaho and watch base jumping. And when I showed up, it was like 10 o'clock PM. All the base jumpers I was going to meet were at, you know, Texas Roadhouse having tons of drinks. They were all hammered, and they had already decided that they were going to throw me off the bridge the next day. And the person that I went there to meet had told them that I had 200 skydives, and I just kind of went along with it and fell in love with base jumping. And definitely realized that I didn't have a lot of experience, and instead of jumping full throttle into it, continued to skydive, continued to only jump really beginner friendly objects that, you know, because I knew I was new at canopy piloting and all that. So I like to think that I did a not super responsible thing as safely as could have been done.
Well, speaking of that, one of the skydivers I had on was Alistair McCartney. I don't know if you've come across him before, but in the interview, I remember him saying, you know, people will say, well, you know, it's 99% safe or whatever the term that would be used. And he's like, but you can't do that in base jumping. He's like, mm-hmm. You know, that 1% means you died. Because so we were talking about the diligence of training. The perception that people have is, you know, a lot of the extreme sports people are, you know, foolish and they're taking unnecessary risks. But you listen to the diligence of the training, mm-hmm. It makes you realize, same with Alex Honnold. I mean, we were talking about Jimmy Chin earlier, you know, the free solo. I mean, the number mm-hmm. of times that he prepared for that route, he basically got to the point where he couldn't fail. So just elaborate on that a little bit, you know, because my profession, again, you know, if we don't prepare properly, we could die as well. So what is the kind of behind the scenes as far as a preparation for, you know, base, wingsuit, some of the extreme stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, that's a great question that you asked. And it's funny you bring up, you know, Alex Honnold and Jimmy Chin, because we're actually shooting a Jimmy Chin documentary right now for the Sphere that is also featuring Alex Honnold. And the premise behind it, the documentary is called From the Edge. And that is the premise. It's about why do we do what we do? And what's the behind the scenes? What's the planning and the thought process that goes into something that you just watch a one-minute clip on Instagram or on YouTube and you're like, oh, that guy's crazy. But what you don't see is, you know, the years of preparation and the, you know, maybe just there's so much thought that goes into it that you don't see from that 1 minute clip that you watch. And like in the base jumping side, you know, it depends on what your goals are. Like say your goal is to wingsuit base jump. I'll use an example. There's a jump that I wanted to do called Pise de Lec, and it's in the Dolomites, and it's this amazing wingsuit base jump that I watched a video. I was like, oh my God, I want to do that. But basically you jump off the exit, you fly right, and then you can either just kind of fly down and land safely. And it's a fairly, you know, I hate to use the word boring, but like, you know, there's not a lot going on the flight, or you can fly to the right of this ridgeline. And basically you're like entrenched in this crack between the cliff you just jumped off on your hard right and this whole nother cliff band that's now on your left, you know, and, it's something that you watch and there's, it looks cool, but you don't realize, you know, it's easy to get judged for like, oh man, that guy's stupid. He has a death wish. But what you don't see is like, all right, I'm going to go get all this GPS data on what my exits look like. I'm going to make sure that I know my data points overlay this jump I can do. I'm going to make sure I learn about reading the weather. I'm going to make sure that my, you know, the first few jumps I do off it, I'm flying around it, just doing reconnaissance to make sure that I'm hitting the checkpoints I could if I wanted to go into that entry gate, you know, making sure that I'm taking into consideration that, you know, conditions change from jump to jump. And just because the last time I was here, I could have made it to that entry gate, realizing in the moment not to get caught up into that and making sure you're assessing on, you know, the jump that you're going to go for it, that your plan is still to, or at least for me, to bail and fly around it, unless it's just begging to be jumped and you're still hitting all your checkpoints that maybe you have sinkier conditions and you're not going to, you know, there's so much that goes into it. And then the first time that I, not the first time I did that jump, but it's like the first time I flew that line, I was grinning from ear to ear and I was thinking, man, I'm doing it. I was so excited and I was so proud of the fact that I had flown it. But the thing that I was most proud about was my approach to it, and that I didn't just go fly this line that I thought looked really cool, was that I had a really measured approach to how I did it. And, you know, and those are the kind of things that you don't necessarily see from just watching somebody's video and thinking that they're crazy. And that if somebody is reining it back, you know, say if you fly at 100% and you're flying to the edge of your performance envelope all the time, you know, things eventually go wrong. And if you're not padding kind of your margin for error so that you can accommodate for those things to go wrong, eventually when they go wrong, you're going to get really hurt or die. And, you know, everyone's 80% looks different. So it's hard to judge someone based just off what they're doing without knowing the person and knowing that the work that they've put in, because some people are flying at 100% and they are idiots and they are probably going to die, but someone else might be flying. They're just really good and they've put in a ton of work and it might look crazy to me watching it. And then you realize that that person is just that good and they really are padding it and they're flying at their 80%. And I think that's just something interesting and a good lesson to keep in mind. But the most important part of that is to realize that you can't fly at your max and pushing it all the time, because something will go wrong eventually. And then you won't get to have this wonderful experience of life anymore.
I've never even thought of it that way. If I think of it in like the gym, totally different example, but you know, when I was younger and CrossFit was younger, you know, there'd be that one rep max that everyone was trying to get. And, you know, more often than not, you'd be sore as hell for a few days if you didn't, you know, F your back up. But now as we've matured, you know, my gym, we do a 5 rep max or a 3 rep maybe. And, you know, for me now, if you looked at me, not that I'm going to be lifting that heavy at all, I'm never going to that 100% anymore, because I'm 51 and I want to, as you said, have that envelope. I'm happy working in that envelope because there is a margin for error. If I lose, you know, the kind of brace in my back slightly, I'm not going to be so heavy that it's going to tear everything apart again. And from the outside looking in, someone who's performing at a high level, it's a great, great point. We would think, oh, that's their 100%, but it's not. You've still got that margin for error. And this seems to line up with what a few of your peers have said on the show. I think Dukes and some other people talked about this. You've got this kind of copycat element that are seeing people like yourselves and then taking shortcuts in the base, you know, community or wingsuit community. And now they are, as you alluded to, at that 100%, and the moment there is a change in, you know, weather or whatever it is, you see these catastrophic accidents.
You do. And it's interesting you bring that up too, because I mean, we talked about that. I just had an accident a few years ago, and I'm not the things that I've just been talking about are things that I've learned and held close, you know, to myself throughout my career. And it doesn't mean that I'm infallible and don't mess up either. And I feel like that's part of the reason that got me into my accident. Man, I thought I was safely past this point, not in my 20s anymore, you know, and I still got caught up with forcing it. There was a line that I really wanted to jump. I'd watched a video of a friend fly it, and I wanted it. And it's funny how when you want something really badly and are essentially forcing it, that you can justify things that if you took a step back and were looking more objectively, like, no, that's probably not a good idea. But, you know, when you're in the middle of it, I think that me personally, I lost sight of some of those lessons that I had learned and went out to go do this jump that I wanted really badly. And it was at high altitude, you know, so the air is less dense. It was a warmer day than, you know, it was a warm day. And so the air is less dense. And intuition, we haven't talked about that yet, but I think that intuition, man, is something, this deeper sense trying to tell you something. And I think that it's really worth listening to. And my intuition was telling me something was off that day, and I didn't really want to do the jump, but I wanted it. That's why I was there. And I felt like this was my opportunity. And no one had ever jumped to the exit that we were jumping. It was farther back in a gully and lower than the exit we had watched someone jump on that video. And even though what we call like the rock drop was higher, so like the actual distance to get your vertical distance to get flying was higher, the exit overall was lower, and it was a fairly flat jump, like where you have to have a pretty good glide to get out. And conditions were not lifty like they were when I watched that friend fly. And there was three of us out there that day, and the first person went and he called back up and he basically said, oh, it's kind of sinky, you know, but you should be good. And it's like, it wasn't good. It was sinky. My intuition was telling me not to go there or not to jump. It was forced. Like, I just wasn't in the right headspace. The whole thing had so many red flags, and I just figured it would be okay. And from the moment I exited, it didn't feel good. The exact thought in my head was, what the fuck? Like, I didn't think I would be this low in this gully. And, you know, it's the beginning of the jump. I was optimistic that I was still going to have enough clearance to get over this ridgeline to the right, which was plan A. Plan B was to just fly, get ridge lift and fly kind of high up on the ridge, use the lift and just fly down to the bottom and deploy my parachute. And I was just kept looking for my opportunities to cross that ridgeline. And I was just never really high enough over the ground that I was in a comfortable place. I never felt really high enough to pull, nor were there any good landing areas up there. And was trying different things to get more altitude. I was trying to fly glidier, which would give you separation from the ground because you would gain altitude, but flying with max glide gives you a really slow speed, which is dangerous because speed equals lift. And if you don't have enough power from flying fast, you can't pull away from terrain when you need to. And it was not good. It's like, so I was flying max glide and thinking, this is stupid. I shouldn't be flying max glide and it's not working. So I tried to pitch a little bit steeper and pick up speed so that I could kind of like flare away from the terrain, and couldn't do that. And just watching my opportunities disappear, you know, and finally I was like, I'm pretty sure that was the last opportunity to cross it. I wasn't high enough. And before you know it, I was just so low in this canyon, not really at an altitude high enough to pull. And the gully just like flattens out into, there's no like cliff band at the bottom where you gain altitude again. It just kind of melts into the horizon. And I had a solid like 15 seconds to realize that that was probably the last 15 seconds of my life. And, you know, I think when you're having an intense moment, I experience this thing called like time dilation. And so 15 seconds is like an eternity to think about how I had just effed up. I was so mad at myself. And there was no like moment of like, well, I had a good life. I was so pissed and in denial. I was like, are you serious? Are you kidding me right now? And, you know, I thought about my family. I thought about like, man, I've always wondered what people's last thoughts are before they go in. And I was like, man, I guess I'm having those thoughts right now. That's weird. Like, and I was like, well, this sucks, but it's about to just all be black. And I was like, I'm not going to go in without not at least going through the motions of trying. And I threw my pilot chute, which for those of you who aren't familiar with skydiving and base jumping, the pilot chute's that little parachute that pulls out the big parachute. I threw my pilot chute basically as I hit the one tree that was around in this rocky gully and basically hit a decomposing log. I went through the tree, headfirst through the tree, smashed into a decomposing log and like did a backwards somersault and stood up. And I was like, why am I not dead? Like, how am I conscious right now? And how am I standing? I was like, there's no way I'm okay. Like, my legs must be broken. I'm standing on adrenaline. Like, and I was like, all right, do I know who I am, where I am, like when I am, what happened? I was like, well, that's probably a good sign that I know to even check those things. And then I looked at my parachute in the tree. And that's when I was like, oh my God, my parachute was still completely packed together. And the slider that slows the deployment down so you don't break your neck because it opens too hard was still all the way up in the parachute, meaning my parachute hadn't really started to deploy. And I don't know if just like the, you know, if it snagged in the tree and helped decelerate me, I'm not totally sure. I don't know. None of it makes any sense to me, which is something I had to come to grips with. The why of why I'm still alive. But I called the person who hadn't jumped yet, because basically I disappeared from view from the person on the top, and I never appeared from view to the person on the ground. So nobody saw what happened. And I was wearing a camera, which we saw later the footage from, which is pretty insane. But I called the guy on the top to tell him it's not good, don't jump. And he was also, as it turns out, we talked about later, a little unsettled up there, similar to how I was feeling. And he turned his phone onto airplane mode so that no one would disturb him. And so he jumped. I got a hold of the guy that was on the ground and said, I landed in a tree. I think I'm okay, but I need help, which is like the understatement of the century. Like, I watched the footage recently. I was like, it's so not clear what happened from what I said. Like, I'm sure he thought I just opened, landed in a tree and was being a wuss, you know? And I started to walk down the gully and there was a bunch of bees. You can't make this up, right? There was a bunch of bees and I think I'm allergic to bees. I was like, are you serious right now? So I turned around. This is after I stashed all my gear. And started walk up the gully to find a path to get found. And as I was stashing my gear, it started to become difficult to breathe. And, you know, a moment set in of like definitely realizing because of the mechanism of injury and what I was experiencing that this could be really bad, and I was pretty far from help, and really having to just coach myself through staying calm. I was in a pretty bad situation, and freaking out wasn't going to help anything. And if I'm far from help, the only way to get closer, even if it seems really far away, is to just start moving towards it. And so, walked up the gully, found a path, found my friends, gave them my gear, and one person went to go get the car, and I found the closest level one trauma center and called report on myself. And someone saw my friend running, you know, to get the car and just said, "Do you need help?" And he said, "Yeah," because the car was pretty far away, like over a mile. And my friend jumped on the back of this guy's dirt bike, went and got the car, came and picked up me and the friend that was with me and took me to the hospital. And yeah, that's kind of the beginning of that journey.
What was the difficulty breathing specifically? Was that tension pneumo or hemothorax?
I was worried about that. I was worried about pericardial effusions. I was worried about all kinds of stuff going on in my chest. And it turns out it was a pulmonary contusion. So I had a bruised lung and mild concussion while I was in the hospital. Part of my vision started getting pretty weird. And they ultrasounded in my eyeball. They did so many scans. They put me back in the CT machine for a CTA. Like they checked everything. And I had basically bruised bones and was pretty bruised up, but I didn't break anything and had a mild concussion, which is unreal. Absolutely unreal.
I had a bone bruise in my fist in the kickboxing, in a match, not really a match, but in training. But it went full contact. It was like Fight Club, and took forever to heal. And then one of the physicians I saw said that you'd be much better off just breaking your bone. My bone bruises are a nightmare. So did it take a long time for those contusions?
It took a couple months, I think, for the one on my lower leg, like my tibial plateau area was hurt for a couple months to walk on. And I think I have pretty dense bones. I did a DEXA scan one time for like body composition. And honestly, I think it's because I'm allergic to milk. And so my mom always made sure I got tons of calcium growing up, like very mindfully. And that and a lifetime of weightlifting and weight bearing exercise, I think, has definitely saved me from a lot of injury.
Yeah, I'm the same. I've never broken a bone. I'm going to knock on wood now. I'm probably going to fall over after this interview and break my face.
Not quite the same. I've broken a few.
Yeah, but even when I was a lifeguard, like they hated me, you know, having to tow me when we were doing partner drills because my legs just sink straight down. If I exhale, I end up on the bottom of the pool. So yeah, but it's a good thing, definitely. But talk to me about the rehabilitation journey. We kind of touched on this before we hit record. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you'd been in a motorcycle accident prior mm-hmm. to this. So yeah. What was the difference about this journey? And then what was the mental impact of such a terrifying near miss?
Yeah, good questions. The motorcycle accident was in 2012. And I was basically not seen by a car. And someone swerved in front of me and I got thrown off my bike. I was on a Gixxer 750, but not doing anything wild. I was on just like a 2-lane country road with no cross streets, and a guy swerved into a driveway who was missing. And I clipped the back of the car and got thrown off my bike and went through a mailbox and smashed like back first into a metal fence and broke C7, T1, T2. T3, T5, T8, T9, L3, separated my AC joint in my left shoulder, shattered my scapula, broke most of my ribs on the left side, collapsed my lung, and tore my knee open through the joint.
If you just drank milk, you would have been fine.
That's hilarious. So, you know, and again, it was really hard to breathe like immediately. And you know, I also thought that I was going to get left there. The guy that caused the accident, after what felt like an eternity, finally came over just inside my field of vision, put his hands on his head and like looked around up and down the street and turned around to walk away. And somebody came running out of their house in the middle of nowhere and had called 911 and stuck by me until I went to the hospital. But for that, the rehabilitation was, it's so all encompassing, right? My body was so damaged. It consumed my life. My life was rehabilitating my body, which in some ways is easier than just breaking your arm, which I've done before too, where you're like, God, I want to do everything. I feel fine, but I can't because my arm hurts. This is like, okay, it trumps everything going on in my life. And celebrating those small wins. Like I remember the first time I could lift my elbow off the bed to reach for something. I was still in the hospital. I was like, oh my gosh, things are starting to work again, you know? And I found out, you know, that I had this really innate, just intrinsic motivation to get better. And I feel really thankful for that. Because that amount of injury could have been, you know, I had every excuse to take painkillers and complain about my back hurting, but the only person who would have lost in that would be me. I didn't want to be on pain medicine. And I just wanted my life back. I didn't want excuses. I wanted to go skydiving. So, you know, I worked really, really hard. And, you know, when I got in that accident was, during the world record, the 164-way head down world record, or the 138-way head down world record. And I was barely good enough to be on it. Maybe I would have got cut, very likely, but I at least would have gotten a shot. And it meant a lot to me 3 years later to be on the next world record. I was on the 164-way and back on track to live my life. You know, it's not to say I don't have a little bit of residual stuff, but in my day-to-day life, I don't feel held back by that at all. So, you know, the big thing in that accident was physical. While in the accident that I had more recently, it was much more emotional. You know, ultimately my body was okay. And I was having a hard time for sure. My life felt, completely meaningless. I thought, you know, what's the point if I work so hard to eat well and take care of my body and, you know, sacrifice, you know, fun things for the betterment of my health and future. And then you snap your fingers and it's all over. Like, what's it all for? I didn't get the point. And, you know, my life felt meaningless, but at the same time, I felt completely risk averse. You know, I started having panic attacks for the first time in my life, which is quite humbling for someone who feels like they have their mental game together. And, you know, dealing with anxiety and, it was difficult. It was difficult to deal with, you know, didn't know if I really wanted to wingsuit base jump anymore. I went on a wingsuit base jumping trip. I already had one planned like the next month. And also the 200 way have a tendency to get hurt in July. The next world record attempts, which we ultimately didn't break the world record, were right after that. And I was just trying not to freak out in the airplane while we were like going slow after takeoff, flying over a quarry, because I looked out the window and just felt close to the ground going slow, you know? And basically I was not in a good headspace. Wingsuit base jumping was terrifying. Like I wasn't doing well. And I had to step back and reanalyze, like, how am I trying to rehabilitate myself? I have a lot of work to do. I can't just keep pushing through thinking things are going to feel better without changing how I'm trying to heal from this. And wasn't sure if I wanted to wingsuit base jump anymore, but did decide that if I chose not to, it was going to be from a healed mindset where I just decided that wasn't what I want, and not from a place of fear. And so I put in a lot of work. I did a lot of journaling, you know, I sat with the discomfort of trying to analyze what happened, radical ownership of my mistakes leading up to it, which, man, it sucks to screw up. It sucks making huge mistakes and it's not fun to think about them. But the only way to truly learn from it, to make sure that I never made those mistakes again and to change my approach to wingsuit base jumping, was to ultimately sit with immense discomfort and do a lot of internal analyzing. And after analyzing what happened and what was my part in it, figuring out how it would never happen again and what my goals were with wingsuit base jumping and what my tolerances were also. And ultimately, you know, there's a lot of lessons learned from it, but one is, even though I have the skill set to jump something, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily within my risk tolerance anymore either. And I don't have anything to prove, and even to myself. And modernized some way, you know, some things I was doing, got better with analyzing data. And even though I don't like it, I like flying, I don't like computers, you know, but realizing that there's so much that can be learned from the modern way of doing things, and really finding kind of a new mentor to teach me those things that I felt safe with too. I'm an experienced jumper, but someone who would nurture that environment for asking basic questions and be stoked for me instead of making me feel dumb about it was important to me too. And so surrounding myself with a team of amazing people and putting in a lot of work, and that piece de lac jump that I talked about earlier had compounded significance to me because it wasn't just my approach to that one jump in particular. That was also kind of a pivotal moment of me in that longer rehabilitation from being in that accident to feeling like I was accomplished and in a better headspace and better with my wingsuit base jumping than I was before my accident. So that was a pretty special jump for me. And Eric was there on that jump too. I know he's a mutual friend of ours, Eric and Pat Walker. I don't want to say a quote because I'm probably going to screw it up, but basically I was watching Instagram and I don't even remember who said this, but basically he said that healing isn't a peaceful process and that you have to sit with what broke you or what you broke until you understand it. And so I am very proud of that uncomfortable journey that I've gone through. And, you know, it was never a secret, my accident, but I also didn't broadcast it because I had a lot of work to do and I didn't really need external people either validating or whatever. I didn't need their input. I needed to figure out what I was going through myself. And now I'm in a place where I feel like I can talk about it, and hopefully other people can learn from it. And yeah, I'm more comfortable sharing that story now.
Well, I'm glad you did. Thank you. I mean, it's so powerful. Before the accident, where were you at spiritually wise? Were you, you know, a believer in a certain religion? Did you have a relationship with God? And then what was that journey after?
You know, that's a good question. And I didn't grow up in a very religious household. I would call my mom agnostic and my dad is an atheist, but they were always very supportive of my own spiritual curiosity and journey. And I think that in early adulthood, I have started to kind of find my own way. And it's not an organized religion, but I very much am a spiritual person and do believe that there's something else out there and kind of a thread that connects us all. And that intuition, I think, is a thing that we tap into with that. And you know, I've had to kind of surrender, for lack of a better term, that I won't understand why I'm still alive. And I'm okay with that now. But I do feel like I'm not done here. I feel like I feel like I'm here to be a leader and a teacher and someone who inspires and inspires through following my own passion. And I think if nothing else, you know, I'm still that person, and it's just even more solidified. And it's hard to explain aspects of spirituality other than I very much feel like I'm where I'm meant to be right now. And I feel like I'm on my path. And when in my life, I've had the courage to kind of yank the safety net out from under me and like really go for it and follow my heart and what calls me, there has been so much opportunity that presents itself, but it presents itself after. It's like being rewarded for having the courage to follow my heart. And I feel like I'm very much in the middle of one of those periods of my life right now. Hopefully that will never end. That's just the state I want to live in. But yeah, I would say I feel very connected to spirituality and source, or whatever you want to call it. And especially since my accident.
That's really interesting. I'm similar. I grew up, you know, not really even in a Christian household, because, you know, neither of my parents were actively practicing that, but I was exposed to the Church of England. Ironically, I went to a Christian secondary school, and let's just say I don't think a lot of the people that went to the school were participating in it. There's a guy would come, I forget how often now, but we'd get the local vicar would give us a talk, and he'd hand out a magazine called Jesus and Me. And then we'd all roll it up and then have fights with it in the next playtime. So I'm not sure how religious my schoolmates actually were, but I found myself with that common denominator. As I've said, you know, don't be a dick is pretty much universal. But I don't believe that God has a plan as far as James is still alive and didn't die in a fire or in a car wreck or anything. But this 8-month-old is dying of leukemia. You know, I don't think that he's moving chess pieces around, but we are still here. And so for me, I mean, I see God in nature already. I think this experience that we're having is absolutely incredible. But if you are still here, then to me, it's gratitude. You're still here. So what can you do? How can you make the world better? Because that's all we know. I don't know anything else. I don't know of a heaven or any of that stuff. But I know that if I try and do good things, that it will benefit other people. And it's not about me. It's about us. So it feels like there's a similar connection there.
Definitely. And it's just interesting you bring up gratitude too. I've started, you know, a practice where I spend time each morning, you know, either doing something for myself, whether that's journaling, which when I journal, it's not super structured. So I don't make it sound that way. It's like whatever's on my mind. If I just need to hemorrhage what's on my mind, I do that. If I'm not sure what I want to journal about, which is often, I start with 5 things that I'm grateful for. And it really does put you into a positive mindset for your day. And something, a good friend of mine, his name's Mort, and I love this so much. He calls it MRI, and it stands for the most reasonable interpretation. And it's like when you're faced with things that come up in your life that it's so easy to, you know, make up these things in your head that you start to get anxious over or pissed off at that are just stories that you're telling yourself. It's like, wait a minute, what's the most reasonable way that I can interpret this? What's like the best case scenario I can think of? You know, it's not to say you don't prepare for worst case, but it's like, all right, if this person did this, what's the best case that I can think of that they might be doing that for, you know? And it's just a different mindset to be in, to think the best of people and to be positive and, you know, try and bring the team up and do what's good for other people, just be a good person. And I think that, you know, those are the lessons that people are supposed to feel theoretically, right? With religion. Also, you feel spiritual, you feel close to God or whatever you want to call it. And I think that a lot of people that go to church aren't very spiritual. Probably they're going because they feel like they are supposed to be going, or that's what they were taught to do. And I think it's such a blessing when you can actually feel that in your own life through your own experiences, that you just feel like this, you know, the majesty of nature or the beauty of, you know, sharing a connection with people. And I think that is what the message was supposed to be. And, you know, and I feel that, and I hope that other people can too, whether they do that through organized religion or on their own. But that's just kind of my own personal view.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree 100%. Well, kind of switching tact a little bit now. I was in the stunt world for 22-ish years, mainly in the live stunt show side. I never got into film and television. I was in film and television, but basically as a glorified actor, glorified extra, excuse me. So loved the stunt world when it came to the live show. How did you transition from, you know, skydiving just for the pure passion of the sport to using that as far as the entertainment side?
The entertainment side being stunts?
Stunts, yeah. Well, the movie, yeah. Television, etc.
Oh, man, that's the dream. Everyone wants to be in stunts. They're badass when they're on the, at least, you know, the aerial side. Stunts in general, you know, if I were in my 20s and had known about it, I think that probably would have been a pretty good career path. But now that I'm not in my 20s, that just looks like a lot of getting beat up and uncomfortable falling down. But like the creme de la creme of stunts, at least from someone who's a skydiver, is I want to do those cool aerial jobs. Like, they're rad. And it's definitely Eric I have to thank for that, for bringing me in on one that actually came to fruition, which was so special. It's one of the, you know, coolest experiences that I've had in skydiving or base jumping. And that was for the Marvel movie Thunderbolts that just came out in May.
That was a great, great film.
It was a great film. I loved it so much. Stunts aside, I just loved the movie. The opportunity came up almost, I think, 2 years ago at this point, and we talked about it for a year, and it was going to happen and then not going to happen and then going to happen again. And ultimately, after that roller coaster, it did happen, and we went to Malaysia and got to jump off the second highest building in the world, which was incredibly rad. Like, obviously the stunt was cool, but I think that what really stuck out to me was that I got a glimpse into the world of stunts, right? Because I know the aerial world, but it was so cool to see what a family and a community and a tribe that was. And I'm not sure like the ins and outs of what exactly the strikes were going on in Hollywood leading up to that. But I think that the end result was people who normally all run their own teams, they're all very accomplished within the stunt world, instead of all running their own teams on different projects, we're all working on that project. And there was just so much experience and so much camaraderie between them. I felt like so honored and privileged to be a part of their world for that. And it was just a really special thing to get to experience. And then obviously the jump was cool. I just had a wonderful team of people over there.
What was different when you're now jumping within a set? What was different compared to if you just jumped, you know, recreationally?
Jumping within a set is different because you're, you know, there's like 100 people there watching, and, you know, you're jumping on someone else's cue, which honestly, it's like they warned me, and I love, you know, the people who are mentors in it, John DeVore, you know, and Tim Rigby, you know, are super experienced in that stunt world also, and Eric. But I remember specifically Tim was sharing knowledge, which I love. Tim is incredible. And just saying, like, you know, at the end of the day, Katie, make sure that you're not jumping if you're not comfortable, and that kind of thing. And I appreciated so much his talking to me about that. But to be quite honest, I feel like, you know, I'm comfortable enough with who I am and where I am in my base jumping. I don't really mind the, like, quote, pressure of, you can have 5,000 people watching me. I don't really care, because it's really, I can just kind of shut them out. And when it came down to it, you know, Pat, who is my camera guy and a really good friend, he and I were the jumpers, and we're standing up there, and you know, when they're giving the 30-second call or whatever, it really just feels like me and Pat just like giggling because we are so stoked we get to jump off this thing. And, you know, it was easy to make the rest melt away and just focus on him and doing the job. And, you know, that's in that one circumstance. It's not to say that, you know, potentially in another job or someone else having different circumstances, it can be harder to tune that out. But on that job, in that moment with that team, it was really no problem. And it was just very gratifying to be able to do that. I was proud of myself for the job that I performed. And I feel like working well within the team and just having fun with my friend Pat, which is what it really felt like in the moment. So it was pretty cool.
You just reminded me of another important thing I've heard from a lot of people, especially Chris McDougal, Dukes, that talked about this. And just to preface this, there was a story the other day online of an airline pilot. They'd done some sort of maintenance thing. I think it was supposed to go to Hawaii. And he said, I just don't feel right about this. And he ended up saying we're not flying. You know, if there's another plane available, then we'll deplane and get onto the next one, or we might have to postpone until another one does come. And he was trusting his gut instinct. And I remember Dukes talking about, you know, some of the jumps that you guys do. There's a 2-hour hike that, you know, is before it. And despite all of that work, he would say, when it didn't feel right, I'd be like, nope. And we'd turn around and we'd walk 2 hours back down again. So talk to me about that. You know, you were told, hey, don't jump if it doesn't feel right. Talk to me about the responsibility to yourself of trusting that intuition, even if you've done, you know, hours of preparation prior to that jump.
Well, that's interesting. I feel like that's kind of touching on two things. One is not jumping if it's not good, right? Sometimes you get up there and you're like, oh, conditions suck. That's an easy one to walk away from. When conditions are marginal is the hardest, right? When you're like, it's not really clear one way or the other. And I feel like intuition plays the biggest part when everything looks fine and you can't really put your finger on why, but something doesn't feel right. And, you know, that's an important thing to be able to pay attention to also. And just trusting that, you know, your subconscious knows something that you don't and it's trying to tell you. And you'll never, you know, you're not going to die from the jump that you didn't do, probably. So, you know, unless there's, I laugh because there's exceptions to that. Sometimes the approach or, you know, the retreat is dangerous, you know, and, you know, there's been times where I felt more comfortable jumping off something than going back the way we came. So it's not like it's a one size fits all, like, oh, if it's not good, turn around. But in general, for sure, Dukes is totally right. You know, it's worth being uncomfortable or tired or hungry to turn around and leave and have a story to tell and live another day than jump when it's not good. And there's been a lot of jumps that I've turned around, walked off of over the years, you know, sitting up there thinking like, it's just not worth it. Or like, what? If my mom was sitting here talking to me about it, it's like, I got to make a good decision, you know? And yeah, Dukes is totally right. I think most jumpers would agree with him on that.
It's interesting because that carries over to my profession. And, you know, we've got a very young fire service at the moment. You know, I think a lot of departments, about half their department have got 5 years or less on. And, you know, there's of course, the overly cautious side of the fire service where they don't want anyone going in and we'll just get it from the outside. And there's times where that's wrong. You know, there's a rescue that you could facilitate. And so you do have to make entry. But then there's also, and I feel like this kind of mirrors the copycatting that we're talking about that gets a lot of skydivers hurt or killed, where it's a very chest beating machismo. We go in on every fire, you know, and there's many times where you just can't, like the conditions dictate that there is no one viable in there. And it's only risking more firefighters' lives by blindly going into a fire you got no business going into. So I think, you know, for us, that intuition, which I think comes with experience too, and that's the dangerous part of having such a recruitment crisis and therefore a young fire department, is you've got all these people on scene, arguably who may not have seen enough to really develop that intuition in the first place, blindly go into a fire and then, you know, lose their lives too.
Yeah, I think that you're spot on. There's a lot of similarities between the two things. And, you know, the more experience you can get, the more, you know, broad of a knowledge base you have to make better decisions in the future.
Absolutely. Well, before we go to the Sphere, are there any other Hollywood productions that you've been working on?
I wish.
The next one.
I'm ready and available.
Well, let's talk about that then. So Jimmy Chin, renowned, you know, filmmaker, you know, documentarian, obviously Alex Honnold, legend in himself. How did you come across this project? And then, you know, tell us what we can expect and when.
That is a great question. I got cold called, to be honest. And this guy, Davey, who has become a friend of mine, basically it was his brainchild for this whole project. And he had reached out to me he said he tried to find an agent and reached out to me through a few different platforms. And basically it was an Instagram message caught in a filter because we weren't connected, you know, that said, hey, are you interested in doing this documentary, blah, blah, blah. And the answer is always yes until it's no, right? I wanted more information. So I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Signed an NDA, which I'm not going to divulge anything in the NDA that hasn't already been publicly put out, but basically I signed the NDA. And then he said it was for the Sphere in Las Vegas. I saw Jimmy Chin's name on it. I was like, what is happening? It's like, I'm in. And he sent me the pitch that had, you know, it was like 30 slides of like info. It was so in depth. I couldn't believe it had so much information on me. And it looked incredible. And basically, like we touched on earlier, the premise is about why do we do what we do? You know, so I'll back up and say it's an hour, you know, it's a documentary featuring five different extreme sports athletes, each from a different extreme sport. With Alex Honnold is the climber, Kai Lenny is surfing, Marcus Etter is a skier, and Alenka Artnik is a free diver. And I just feel so honored to have my name amongst theirs. It's, you know, it's a dream come true for sure. It's about why we do what we do, you know, what's the common thread. Maybe we all do different extreme sports, but what makes us tick? Why, what draws us to these things? And, you know, what is the experience and the analysis and the forethought and the training, you know, that goes into all this that people don't necessarily see. And I think, you know, Jimmy, and I just want to mention too, Chai is also directing it. But Jimmy is an athlete, you know, and he wants to bring these things to light from experience. And it really shows in the way that he directs and the questions he asks and the, you know, the way that I felt we already did some of the filming for it. And he also made it very clear, you know, that in the moment, enjoy myself and that we can reset everything and don't go if it doesn't feel right, you know, and just felt very supported from the athlete side, but he very much is inspired to capture, you know, the beauty of all of the mindset that goes behind it. And it should be an incredible documentary.
Sounds amazing. When are they hoping it's going to be at the Sphere?
The last thing that I saw released said estimated fall or winter of 2026. So about a year and a half.
Is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
I think I would actually recommend my husband, Matt Lajeunesse. He has an incredible story, was briefly a firefighter for about 6 months. And then, yeah, I'll let him tell his story about why that didn't keep going. And is also one of, yeah, Sean Chuma's best friends. And I think that everyone would love it.
Let's make it happen then. I'd love to have him on. Thank you.
Awesome.
All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you, what do you do to decompress?
Oh, I read books a lot to decompress. If it's in the evening and to stay kind of even keeled, I practice mindfulness in the morning. And even if it's for 5 or 15 minutes, really try to just get up a few minutes early when it's still quiet and basically just center myself. And I've been pretty committed to a meditation practice that has really helped keep me calm and grounded. And it's interesting. I used to kind of waffle between go, go, go and at home decompressing from trips. And I've really, in the last year, tried to integrate the two together and bring some of that peacefulness into those trips where I'm just charging. And so even when it's easy to get wrapped up in stuff, still trying to spend those few moments each morning detaching from what I'm actually doing in terms of, you know, I don't identify myself by what I do, but who I am. And because we're all just one one choice away from never being able to do these things we love anymore. You know, I could get in an accident and never skydive again. And I think that it wouldn't change who I am. And I make sure that I spend time each moment identifying as Katie Hansen and the things I love and the people I love and the things I care about. And it keeps me a little bit more grounded.
That's exactly what we struggle with in my profession. You know, the identity becomes the firefighter, the Marine, you know, whatever it is. And God forbid you get hurt, you know, you get fired or you just simply retire. If that's all you've seen yourself as, one day you're not anymore, whether you like it or not. And so, you know, but if you see yourself as James Gearing, who wants to help people, and that was in the role of a lifeguard and then the role of a firefighter, and you're this continuing through line, then the things that you did don't necessarily define you anymore.
Exactly.
With the mindfulness, this would be interesting because, I mean, you know, the acuity that you need free falling from the sky is, you know, quite unique. One of the things that I've realized is a lot of the elements that will help with mental health, that will help with, you know, with weight loss, with all these kind of things, you can also kind of, as I say, putting honey on the medicine, as it were, you can also change the lens to performance. So if I've got a, you know, air quotes alpha that doesn't believe that the mental health is a thing, well, I can talk about mindfulness and performance. If you really want to be able to, you know, make entry in a SWAT call or make entry to a burning building and get in that flow state and really see that room in your mind and find that child, you need to have a calm mind. What have you seen as far as meditation and your performance when you're skydiving now?
That is a good question. And honestly, my skydiving, I'm performing well, but I feel like I'm just more even keeled at the end of the day and very comfortable with who I am. And since I started that practice, I've done less competition skydiving and things like that and more bigger projects, I would say. And my ability to stay focused and stay calm through like high pressure filming stuff is the best it's ever been.
I use Headspace, you know, diligently now. It was on and off for a long time, but I'm on a good run at the moment. What kind of practice do you use?
Right now, I'm actually not use. I was on Mindvalley for a while, and I've actually just kind of ventured into. Now I'm exploring just my own. It's not guided, and just kind of have my own routine, things I go through in the morning. And it's not to say I won't do guided stuff again, but I'm really liking where I'm at. And you know, it's always evolving. You can change it. I have masterclass too, and was watching some of that just about meditation, but not necessarily taking you through a guided one. And I will say too, I have noticed like the ability to drop into that headspace is easier the more you practice it. So like if I am on top of, you know, a wingsuit base jump, and I haven't jumped in a while, it's always scarier the first one, you know, when you're not current. And the ability to, it's funny, it's like basically when I put my helmet on, it's almost like a physical conduit into like dropping into that headspace. And, you know, one of the guys that was filming us in Switzerland was saying that he could like feel the energy shift. Because we were goofing around on the ground a lot, but when we were up on the exit, he's like, whoa, because we took him up there with us. He's like, that was interesting to watch, you know, and being able to shift into that headspace of it's still fun, but it's focused. And I think that practicing mindfulness, yeah, helps to draw me into that headspace more easily, which ultimately leads to higher performance. And yeah, it's good for safety and for performance.
Absolutely. Well, for people listening, if they want to learn more about you, follow you, where are the best places online or social media?
Best place online and social media would be through my Instagram right now, which is Fly with Katie, and I spell Katie K-A-T-I-E.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. I mean, all the different facets from the diligence in training and progression when it comes to skydiving and safety, and then, you know, your emotional journey from the accident. There's been so much to kind of glean from this. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks for having me, James.